Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. In the introduction to her work, The Second Sex, Simone de Beauvoir is going to explore the question, just an outline, about where this sort of hard-baked-in notion of female inferiority came from and why it has such a grasp, such a control over culture, even in our own present day, removed from her by a number of decades. And she's casting a long view going all the way back in history. She talks about this self-other dynamic, which she's taking from a certain reading of Hegel's notion of self-consciousness, in which self-consciousness is itself by relating itself to another self-consciousness. And that relation could be antagonistic or it could be equal. It could be a lot of different ways. But in the case of men and women, women have been treated as inferiors throughout pretty much all of history. And it's been men who have essentially defined the structure of that relationship. So she's got a question, how did this come about in the first place? And there's a lot of explanations for it. Now, the one thing that she says that's quite telling is we probably should cast suspicion on all the justifications that men have provided for this fact of women being the other. She says, these have all too evidently been dictated by men's interest. A little-known feminist of the 17th century, Poulain de la Barre, put it this way, all that has been written about women by men should be suspect, for the men are at once judge and party to the lawsuit. So she gives you a number of different examples, and she's looking at different cultural spheres. We could think of religion, and we don't have to just look at Western religion. We could look at all sorts of religions across the world, in which typically, although there may be mother goddesses or some other way of exalting certain women, typically women wind up in an inferior position, and not just being told that you need to be in this position because, you know, men are better than women, but it's in terms of incapacity. It's in terms of not being fully human. It's in terms of not being up to what it is that men can do. Philosophy. We might think she mentions Aristotle, who's a prime example. Aristotle says a lot of boneheaded things about women where, you know, you read it and you're like, man, where did he get that idea from? Some of which are physiological, some of which have to do with their intellectual capacities, some of which have to do with where they ought to be in society. They should be confined to the household, for example. And although he grants a certain ability to women that elevates them above slaves, he still places them below men and claims that this is a natural matter. Many other philosophers have similarly done things like that. We might think of, for example, Jean-Jacques Rousseau as a prime example. Science, throughout the development of the sciences, we have seen people making claims about the incapacities of women vis-a-vis men. Whether it's, you know, phrenologists, you know, looking at the fact that women have smaller brains than men on average, but of course ignoring the fact that the brain-to-body ratio is higher in women. We can come up with all sorts of examples. And if we look at the history of science itself, we see important women being deprived of their place or even any recognition, sometimes having their ideas stolen by male colleagues or poo-pooed because they're women. There's this cycle that keeps on going and on. She also talks about law. She has an interesting example here where she says Roman law limited the rights of women, citing the imbecility, the instability of the sex just when the weakening of family ties seemed to threaten the interest of male heirs. And we could go on and on with examples, and she provides quite a few here as well. Then she says it was only later in the 18th century that genuinely democratic men began to view the matter objectively. Diderot, among others, strove to show that woman is like a man, a human being. John Stuart Mill comes fervently to her defense. But these philosophers displayed unusual impartiality. So they were outliers. They were not really the norm. And if you look at the literature and the history of the 18th and 19th centuries, you see that that definitely is the case. So we have all these different sort of mutually reinforcing cultural spheres in which men are telling stories about just why it is that women don't even get to into these fields to tell the stories about why women are inferior to men. And so we've got a very tight net of cultural domains and agents within them telling a common story. She also mentions economics. And again, she's not trying to provide a comprehensive analysis in the introduction, but she points out a very interesting feature. During the Industrial Revolution, in some respects, women's positions are able to advance and women are being afforded chances to enter the workplace, but there's resistance to that coming not just from the bourgeoisie, as you might say, representatives of traditional values. The bourgeoisie are kind of traditional, kind of revolutionary, but also from the working class themselves. She says, during the Industrial Revolution, one of the consequences is the entrance of women into productive labor. It was just here claims of feminists emerged from the realm of theory and acquired an economic basis, while their opponents became the more aggressive. Landed property lost power to some extent, but the bourgeoisie clung to the old morality that found the guarantee of private property in the solidity of the family, which then required women to remain within the household, not to be out there in the working world. What about the proletariat or the working class, though? She said, even within the working class, the men endeavored to restrain women's liberation. Why? Was it because they said, I want my wife at home making me, you know, my nice meal when I get home? No, there was another reason. They began to see women as dangerous competitors, the more so because women were accustomed to work for lower wages. And you might think of examples of this. The teaching profession, for example, in, you know, the United States and in other places, one reason why teachers' salaries and wages are as low as they are was what was originally a male-dominated profession had an influx of female workers, you could say, or placeholders, however you want to frame it, the people who were doing the actual work, and wages declined as a result. Was it women's fault that wages declined? No, it's the fault of the people who actually were willing to lower the wages, particularly those who could see where this was going to go. But it generated a situation in which people were being paid less and less. And you can see this in, for example, textile workers or other industrial workers as well. Big problem. And so there was this pressure to keep women out of the workplace if possible. Now, she also talks about a number of different features of this attitude of justifying inequality, of saying that women simply don't have the capacities. And one of the things that she talks about here is quite interesting. She says, at most, they were willing to grant equality and difference to the other sex. This formula is the most significant. It's precisely like the equal but separate formula of Jim Crow laws aimed at African Americans. And she says, as is well known, this so-called equalitarian segregation has resulted only in the most extreme discrimination. Now, she talks about this a little bit later on as well. She says that many men will affirm, as if in good faith, women are the equals of men and that they have nothing to clamor for, while at the same time they will say that women can never be the equals of men and their demands are in vain. And she says, it is, in point of fact, a difficult matter for man to realize the extreme importance of social discriminations, which seem outwardly insignificant, but which produce in women moral and intellectual effects so profound that they appear to spring from her original nature. So this notion of formal equality. Well, we're all equal now, aren't we? You know, we've opened up the doors. Anybody can get any job. It ignores the concrete realities of lived existence. One prime example of this is equal opportunity in the workplace, that is, equal opportunity to have jobs, doesn't mean that everybody gets treated the same in job interviews. Or that the same allowance is made for clothing in the workplace. Or that the burdens of paying for a wardrobe don't fall equally or inequally on men and women. And we could go on and on and on with examples of this. This notion of just saying, oh, well, we fixed it all and equality is the case. That's a trope. That's a dodge. And it was happening back in de Beauvoir's time, just as it still happens in ours. She also talks about a vicious cycle of inferiority that we've just touched on a little bit here in this passage, where she said, "It's a difficult matter for men to realize the importance of social discriminations, which seem insignificant, but which produce intellectual and moral effects so profound that they appear to spring from women's original nature. Because of the ways in which women are, you might say, held down, it becomes the case where it's more difficult to succeed." And she talks about this vicious circle, right? She brings it up in terms of race in America. And she says, "This vicious circle is met with in all analogous circumstances. When an individual or a group of individuals is kept in a situation of inferiority, the fact is that they are inferior." And then she says, "There's an important thing to point out here. The significance of the verb to be must be rightly understood. It is bad faith to give it a static value when it really has the dynamic Hegelian sense of to have become." And she says, "Yes, women on the whole are today inferior to men. That is, their situation affords them fewer possibilities. The question is, should that state of affairs continue?" So again, if we want to use jobs as an example, you know, if you're looking for leadership in your company, but the women who could be candidates were deprived of opportunities to hold leadership positions in the past, as opposed to their male colleagues, they're already at a disadvantage. And you can say, well, they're inferior. I'm not going to hire inferior people. They're inferior because they were kept in situations of inferiority. They were excluded, in effect. And this goes on in many different areas of life. And de Beauvoir is far from the only person to point this out. Wollstonecraft spent quite a lot of time on this in her Vindication of the Rights of Women. Another thing that de Beauvoir signals as a problem is this focus on the eternal feminine. And we might translate this as the good girl, the person who fits the conception of what femininity ought to be like, not just getting it from the men, but also from her, you know, fellow alienated women pushing that onto her, who finds herself thereby, in some respect, deprived of the agency that she would need in order to develop, except to develop this eternal feminine. And she says that the eternal feminine corresponds to tropes like the black soul or the Jewish character, and they are both matters of paternalism, of being provided with an identity that you're supposed to take on. This may, in fact, be a more pressing problem in our own time, in part because of the proliferation of social media and conceptions of just what it means to be a real woman, right? The last thing that she talks about that I want to highlight in here is something that we nowadays call entitlement or privilege, and its relationship with insecurity. And she points something out very interesting. She uses several different contemporary authors of her time as examples here in very funny ways. But before that, we should look at the example that she provides, which we see people doing in our own time. She says, "Recently a male student wrote in the Hebdo Latin, 'Every woman student who goes into medicine or law robs us of a job.'" Doesn't that sound familiar? There are still people saying things like that today. "Oh, that's an equal opportunity admission there. They're depriving me of my place that belongs to me automatically." And she goes on, "He never questioned his rights in the world. Economic interests are not the only ones concerned. One of the benefits that oppression confers upon the oppressors is that of the most humble of them is made to feel superior." She uses the example again of the American South. Any white person, no matter how foolish with their money they were, no matter how backwards they were in their manners, no matter how lazy they had shown themselves in their lifestyle, and we could pick all sorts of other character traits out, negative things, could at least stay above the class below that person and say, "At least I'm not black." The same thing happens with men and women. So she gives it as an example. I'll just talk about one of the authors. Claude Marillac said, "We listen on a tone of polite indifference to the most brilliant among women, well knowing that her wit reflects more or less luminously ideas that come from us." And de Beauvoir writes, "Evidently the speaker referred to is not reflecting the ideas of Marillac himself, for no one knows of him having any." But the idea is that, you know, when women say something, it's always going to be derivative of some man. Men are the ones who accomplish things. She goes on and she also says, "I've lingered on this example because this masculine attitude gets shown with disarming ingenuousness. Men profit in many other subtle ways from the otherness, the alterity of women. Here is miraculous balm for those afflicted with an inferiority complex. And indeed, no one is more arrogant towards women, more aggressive or scornful than the man who is anxious about his virility. Those who are not fear-ridden in the presence of their fellow men are much more disposed to recognize a fellow creature in woman. But even to these, the myth of woman, the other, is precious for many reasons. Why? Because it gives them a little shred of confidence about themselves. If they looked at themselves objectively, they would see that they are indeed the ones who are inferior. But because the cultural matrix gives them the possibility of thinking, at least I'm not a woman, they get to have a bit of self-esteem as a result. Unearned in some respects, right? We could say. And I think we can see this dynamic in the present as well going on. So you put all of this together and we have an answer, at least a partial answer, to this question of where did this notion of women as being naturally inferior come from, and why does it remain so powerful within contemporary culture, even in the most advanced societies?
Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/Sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.